I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It's David. It's podcast time. You know the drill. We're trying to make economics, and man, such a year. We're trying to make it a bit more comprehensible, a bit more realistic, and hopefully a little bit more germane to your life. It has been a very, very strange year because we're nearly there to Christmas for economics. I'm joined by the head himself. What's the crack, man?
It's all good. It's only another 3 or 4 more sleeps to Christmas.
Hopefully it's 3, because if it's 4, it's Stephen's Day.
Well, you know, you might sleep through.
Yeah, you have to put the S on Stephen's Day.
Stephen's Day.
Yeah. It's funny because I spend lots of Christmas up the north. I just can't get my head around Boxing Day.
What is the story for Boxing Day?
It's when you box things off.
What?
You put all the presents in boxes, I think, or I don't know.
No, it's not.
Ask someone from Ingerland or somewhere. Anyway.
You have all the decos up, raring to go.
Have you seen our tree?
I did see your tree.
Well, I tell you the story about the
tree. Go on.
Okay. This is one of the many, many advantages of following us on patreon.com/David McWilliams. Because you know the way lots and lots of people will write in every week, you know, and lots and lots of patrons will write in. And about a month ago, I got and I tried to get to most of them. I could stay up, like Shan says, you're mad. I stay up late at night, and maybe we try to do 20, like on a Tuesday night, very late, or a Wednesday or whatever. And I was going through them, and usually they're very, very interesting suggestions, or we like the podcast, but could you do this? But then sometimes there's fellas just chancing their arm.
Your onion old bollocks.
Yeah, there's lots of your onion old bollocks. But I've had about a month ago, about 6 weeks ago, one came in by a fella called Damien Mooney. And I said, hi, Damien, how are you doing? He said, I know this could be a bit, you know, chancy, but I'm going to do an interview. He's a student.
Right.
On economics and finance.
A job interview?
A job interview. He said, you know, he'd never have 5 minutes. And the thing about it is, of course, you always have 5 minutes. Because remember when you were a kid?
Yeah.
If there was somebody could give you just a stare, could give you something, right? So I just called him up. I gave him my number. I called him. And he was going into the interview. And
at that very moment.
He was driving up from Dublin. He's from Offaly.
Right.
And anyway, he did well in the interview. And he called me back and he said, and I just told him, look, you say this, say that, or talk about this. This is the interesting stuff. This, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And he says to me, do you want a Christmas tree? Which I thought was, you know, it was an unusual thing to say. He said, thank you very much. Do you want a Christmas tree? I said, yeah, of course. And I think it's his dad. And his family run a big Christmas tree operation in Offaly. So a couple of days ago, himself, right? And I said, yeah. And I gave him the address. And himself and his mate, Owen Cronin, two lads, Owen and Damon, arrived up here with a massive Christmas tree. Massive one. Wow. And it's up, pride of place.
Oh, no, it's gorgeous, actually.
Yeah, you should have seen, they were trying to turn. It was two lads from the country, right?
Yeah.
And our suburban Cal. And they're trying to explain to Cal how to saw off bits of the end of the tree, and it just wasn't confusing.
And he was going, man!
It was like Martians and Venetians, or people from Mars and people from Venus. But anyway, all I just shout out, Damien and Owen, thank you for the Christmas tree. It is the finest Christmas tree the McWilliamses have ever had. And it was free!
So when's he starting?
His new gig.
His new gig.
I don't know, sometime in the new year. But these
we must get him on the podcast.
We must get him on the podcast. But in actual fact, what he was saying, which was lovely, you know, because they're 21, 22, they were saying that so many of their mates listen, which I find so gratifying, John, that you can take a subject that was quite remote for them, for lots and lots, for thousands of people now,
yeah,
and make it realistic and make it, as we were trying to say, applicable to people's lives.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you get a Christmas tree into the bargain. So that's the crack. That's my crack this week.
Well, what a year it's been.
Wow. Yeah, it really has, John. When you stand back, like, park the COVID for a second. The COVID. It has to be the COVID.
Yeah. It's hard to park the COVID.
It is
though.
Very hard. I know.
It has just been so invasive in everything we've done, everything we've talked about, but also everything in terms of our change of lifestyle, change of our working day, everything.
Everything. I mean, I was thinking the other day about, it seems to me that half of Poland is working for delivery vans these days. I don't know about your door, our door, knock, 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 there's some Wojciech there with another parcel.
Yeah.
But what it's shown is the implication of that for retail is phenomenal, right? The implication we talked about before for rents on Main Street, the implication of that for commercial rents, all this has changed. And what COVID has done, it's done two things. Well, it's done many things. It's accelerated the future.
Yeah.
So the future that might have been in 2025, 2026 is here now in terms of our relationship with tech, our relationship with online. You've got kids learning stuff online. You've got universities online. Think about everything. That's not just shopping.
Yeah.
You've got all our entertainment has been online, right? Which has been a disaster for those of us in the festival business. But we'll come back again. But the other side of that has been this really unique period where interest rates have remained at zero or less than zero.
Mm.
Budget deficits have gone through the roof. And when interest rates are at zero, what you have is you have huge frothiness in financial markets, right? And I think this week we're going to talk about tech, John, from two standpoints. The one standpoint you started on, which is the invasiveness, the pervasiveness, the fact that tech is everywhere and we are unbelievably reliant on it.
Yeah.
And when you're unbelievably reliant on tech, you're unbelievably vulnerable to a tech crash, to hacking, to security, those things.
I think we're even more reliant on it than we probably give credit for it.
And the problem is probably people like you and I still live in an analog age in our heads.
Yeah, very much
but
so.
Yeah, but our reality is a 21st century rapidly accelerating tech world. So that's the first thing. The second thing, which I want to talk about as well, is the valuations of companies. Because when you get a tech boom, right?
Yeah.
And you get low interest rates, it becomes a speculator's charter, right? And the speculator and the investor are two different creatures.
Yes.
The reason I want to talk about is Airbnb, right?
Yeah.
Airbnb, right? Was floated last week and it was supposed to be floated. So the company valued itself $60 a share. So think about that.
Right.
The people who know the company most intimately valued it at $60 a share. The market decided it was worth $140 a share. So people who don't know the company at all, right?
Yeah.
Bid its price up, doubled its price.
So what's going on there?
So that's what I want to talk about.
Right.
That's what I want to talk about. We're in a very crazy moment. So yes, we have tech, without a doubt. And you never bet against technology, right?
Mm.
But the question is, you might like the tech, but what's happening to the valuations? So you've something like Tesla.
Yeah.
Tesla is worth $600 billion. Now, Tesla is a battery company with a car chassis dropped on top of it.
Yeah.
It's not a car company. It's a battery company. That's Elon Musk. That's his whole thing.
Yeah.
Right? Think about it. It's worth six times more than General Motors and Ford combined.
That's outstanding.
It's crazy, right? So the question is,
that's incredible.
Do these valuations. So Airbnb is now traded at twice the value that its own executives thinks it's worth, right?
Yeah.
Tesla, which is a battery company that nobody had heard of 10 years ago, is now worth six times more than these two giants, General Motors and Ford Motor Company. So are we going to face into a massive tech crash? Both in terms of the hacking, but also in terms of the stocks, okay? And what happens? Because we've been here before, John.
Yeah, we have. How does this differ, though, from the likes of the dot-com boom of the 90s.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Before we talk about, is it a second.com? Is that where we're at? Because the conditions are right for that. The conditions are definitely right. Low interest rates. See, what happens in investing and speculating is low interest rates reduce the cost of making mistakes.
Right.
Because you're borrowing for free.
Yeah.
So what you do is you're much more liberal with your cash. They also, low interest rates drive up valuations to levels which are impossible for the company to manage. So that's the one thing, right? The other thing is the pervasiveness of tech. So the idea is it's a dual thing, John. You can embrace technology, but also be skeptical about the valuations of the companies. And that's the whole idea is two things can always be right at the same time.
Right.
You know, but I want to know, is this a problem? Is this overvalued? Should we be worried? But I'll tell you what, to give us a real insight, I want to go now to London to John Thornhill, who is the innovation editor of the Financial Times. He knows his onions. He's been writing about markets, data, tech, its impact, etc., startups, the whole thing. So let's go. Let's talk to the expert, John.
Alrighty.
John, how are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you.
John, tell me about the Airbnb valuations. What do you make of this?
Well, we've seen an extraordinary year, as you're saying, about IPOs or initial public offerings on the American market. A lot of tech companies have listed. And as you say, some of the valuations appear absolutely eye-popping. Airbnb, $100 billion valuation. And a lot of these companies don't actually make any money. I used to be a Lex columnist at the FT and used to write about kind of valuations of companies. And I took rather an old-fashioned view that companies had a valuation that was dependent on how much profits they made, how much earnings they made, how much dividends they would pay out to their shareholders. A lot of these companies don't produce any profits. They don't produce any dividends. So they are very difficult to value on old-fashioned metrics, as it were. And what people are valuing them on are really their future ability to generate profit and the network effects that they create. So kind of Google's and Facebook's in particular have billions of people using their services. They, in fact, are making a load of money, but an Airbnb or an Uber that are not making money have created this astonishing network of people which investors think are going to have a real high valuation and economic worth at some point in the future.
So let's talk about Airbnb, because again, Airbnb is one of those companies that almost everybody has used. Lots of people are aware of, even if they haven't used it, they're about to use it or one of their mates has used it. How come it doesn't make money? This is the first thing that I want to understand. And then the second thing I want to understand is, you know, the this time it's different idea, that probably the four more or three most expensive words in the financial lexicon. So let's talk about that. But first of all, the Airbnb itself, I mean, how come it doesn't make money? Because so many people seem to be using it.
Well, I think a lot of these companies that are growing incredibly fast, like your Ubers and Airbnbs, they are using kind of a technology or a methodology in Silicon Valley called blitzscaling. And Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, has created, wrote a book on this subject. And the idea is that you have to dominate the market. You have to be the biggest player in the world in your sector in order to make money in that in the future. So companies like Uber and Airbnb have made enormous bets on going global and dominating the markets that they're in by creating these phenomenal networks of people. And it has worked to the extent that they are the kind of dominant platforms for booking a room online or booking a cab online. So I think that's part of the reason they are still injecting a huge amount of money, investing a lot of money in growing the network. And when you talk to Airbnb and Uber, they say, well, we could make money tomorrow by just stopping the expansion and turning on the kind of monetization tap and making profits from the network that we have at the moment. I think some people might question whether that's really true, because the moment they do that, other competitors are going to emerge and try to take them on. But that's the theory anyway, that these companies should be enormously valuable in the future.
So John, what we're talking about is, and it's kind of, should be quite worrying for people who believe in the free, you know, free market and competition. We're talking about a dramatic surge in the tendency toward monopoly. And the implications then, John, once those companies become monopoly, for us, the users, are quite stark.
Sure. I draw a distinction here between some of the kind of startup companies, the scale-up companies that are now going public, and some of the established big tech companies, the kind of Amazons, the Apples, the Microsofts, the Facebooks, Googles, which are now enormous companies, and they are massively profitable as well, which speaks to your point about the concentration of power and possible monopoly effects that they have as well. So I think there are kind of two things going on. At one level, you have got the companies that are still scaling and building and are not making very much money. On the other hand, you have got the companies that have established these networks who are now making huge amounts of money from their networks. So there are two things going on. I think we ought to be concerned about the power of some of the big tech companies. And I was looking at some of the stock market valuations the other day. When you look at a company like Apple and Microsoft, they're both in the range of kind of $1.5 to $2 trillion of market capitalization.
It's kind of mad, isn't it? I mean, we're here in Ireland. We have a GDP, which is inflated dramatically, of $350 billion. So that's our entire country has a GDP, which is worth, what, one third of the market cap of Apple.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's Microsoft's valuation is now more than all of the 30 biggest German companies listed on the DAX. So it gives you a sense of the scale of these companies and how investors are betting on them.
Okay, John, let's just talk about, I want to talk briefly about Ireland and our bet. So Ireland has made probably, in global terms, the most concentrated bet, I would suspect, on tech of any small open economy. Where do you think that'll lead us?
Well, I think that the bet on tech in a global sense is absolutely the right one to make. As we've seen through the pandemic, we have all become a lot more reliant on tech. We're shopping online, we're communicating online, we're being entertained online, we're working online. So I think the pandemic has accelerated the future, the digitization of all of our lives. So in a kind of global sense, that's a good bet. I think the world is going to become more connected and we are going to be using these services more and more. Whether it's a good idea to bet on particular companies is another question, I think. And I think what we are seeing is that because of the fears about the monopoly effects that you're talking about, we're seeing a regulatory backlash from the US, the EU and the UK as well, of the regulators, policymakers now trying to get a handle on these enormous companies and whether it's to force them to pay more tax, which has obviously been a big issue in Ireland with Apple, whether it's to get them to open up their networks to more competition, which the EU is trying to pursue, whether it's trying to reverse some of the takeovers that some of these companies have made in the case of Facebook in the US. So I think we're going to see a lot more scrutiny of the big tech companies. But I think the global bet on tech is still a great one to make.
Well, it's interesting. I'm going to come back to the issue of data and vulnerability, because you wrote a very interesting piece on that last week. And it's really, it's fascinating. But just on the, what I would call it, the kind of Rockefeller effect, because, you know, when you talk about these huge companies, massive monopolies, and we have, going back 100 years or 120 odd years, an example where big, big companies, which were tech companies, railroads, oil companies, were actually broken up by the United States in order to militate against what we're talking about is their power. So the American government just came in and took all these robber barons, as they call them, into a room and says, we're going to break you all up. Do you see something like that happening?
Yes, but in a different way. And I mean, you as an economist would understand this a lot better than I would, David. But a lot of antitrust or competition policy has been based on the theory of consumer harm. The companies harming consumers or not? Absolutely, in the case of Standard Oil in America, they were back in the kind of early 20th century because they were increasing prices and killing off the competition in a very obvious way. I think it's harder to make some arguments like that today because Google and Facebook are providing you and I with free services. We are benefiting enormously from the scale effects, the network effects that a Google or a Facebook are providing. So we're getting these amazing free services.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And things you could never have imagined a couple of years ago.
So where is the harm in that, these companies would argue? It is a more subtle argument that the EU in particular is focusing on whether they are now, in effect, killing off their competitors, either by buying them up or whether, because they are such dominant platforms, they are able, in a sense, to see who is going to emerge as a competitor and either kill them or buy them. And I think that is where the competition policy debate is going to go.
And John, I think that's the other fear, of course, is the one that of data, of who owns what, of cyber attacks, of the fact that, you know, we've said that we as consumers get this stuff for free. We couldn't have believed this 10 years ago. But it also means that we are now heavily, heavily reliant in all our lives on tech and a potential crash in tech or an attack or I don't think anybody realizes just how vulnerable we are.
Well, the point I was trying to make in the article I wrote the other day was that just as we looked at the pandemic, and everyone knew that a pandemic was a real risk that was out there, but somehow we never fully internalized it in terms of how we were going to respond to if that happened. So we are now so massively dependent on tech. Just imagine tomorrow if the internet went down, and we had a bit of a Google outage earlier this week. But just imagine that became permanent. How would any of us function in days? We are so dependent on the tech that we are using. And we have seen, and there's an ongoing rolling cyber attack at the moment in America on a lot of kind of government institutions, on some of the biggest companies. And we're seeing these sporadic attacks, which are doing damage to networks, to individual companies, to government ministries. A lot of information is being stolen, some damage is being done. But what if that became generalized? And the truth is that no one quite understands all the connections, the interconnections that exist online. No one really governs the internet. It has been a miraculous kind of emergence of technology. There is no one central authority that runs the internet. And so it is inherently, I think, very vulnerable to cyber attacks, to technical malfunctions. It is astonishing the resilience that there is in the system and the way that very clever technologists have made it resilient. But still, I think we are going to see sporadic cyber attacks on companies and individuals and governments. And it's the opacity of this world that I think is quite unnerving.
And I mean, what's also unnerving is that most of us still live in our heads in the 1990s, or many of us do, okay, of a certain generation. We kind of live in the analog world, and yet in our heads, but in reality, we're living in very much a fast forward 21st century. So there's almost like a time lapse in our heads that our comprehension of what's going on seems to me still quite 20th century in my own case, right? But actually, my day-to-day life is fast forwarding at an unbelievable pace.
I was lucky enough to meet the science fiction writer William Gibson earlier this year, who I think writes wonderful books about kind of our digital age and the future. And he expressed it in a way that we are the last generation that will make a distinction between our offline and our online identities. Wow. That these two are fusing. And I'd never fully kind of got my head around that before, but I think it's a really fascinating concept. I mean, are we a different identity online to what we are offline? Or are we just becoming kind of one merged identity? And if you think of it in those terms, then you look at all of our institutions in a very different way. I mean, as you're saying, they have been built for this analog world. We don't really have any sense of how we're going to govern this online world. And if you imagine that the two are fused, we have a kind of very heavy weighting of analog governance, as it were, and almost a complete absence of digital governance. And I think we have to think about these as a combined entity in the future.
John, just before we go, because it is Christmas time, it has been a pretty weird year. Can I just ask you, can I come back to the original idea of those valuations? Because a lot of people, Irish people, were totally burned by a story many people believed that house prices could only keep going up. And that proved to be a cataclysmic assumption, which destroyed many, many, many lives, destroyed all sorts of economic and psychological, mental health carnage, etc. Are you worried that in all this euphoria about tech, that the old-fashioned way that you were writing in the Lex of valuing companies might come back to bite us? And people will say, you know what, I prefer a company that kind of made something called profit. I know it's very old-fashioned, but it's kind of a nice thing and had a stream of income and had a balance sheet and a set of books that made sense.
Well, the one thing I did learn on Lex was that I would never trust my own judgment in investing in anything, which is why I don't. And as a journalist, I'm not authorized to give any investment advice at all. My kind of personal view about the valuations in the market is we're seeing two things. We're undoubtedly seeing an incredibly kind of frothy tech market that's developing of a lot of the kind of public offerings that are taking place now. And a lot of these companies are going to blow up. They're simply not going to have sustainable economic models. But other companies and a lot of the big tech companies that we've been talking about, the Microsofts, the Amazons, the Apples, are now making a lot of money on any metric that you really look at these companies on. They are generating a lot of money, they fully justify, it seems to me, the valuations that people put in them. And I think the risk in their sense is that there is going to be the kind of regulatory squeeze on these companies, that governments are going to think, well, these companies are just making too much money. They're not paying their fair share of taxes. They are having these monopoly positions that we need to kind of tackle. And so I think there is a regulatory risk to the big tech companies, but a lot of them on most investment metrics are still very solid investments.
John, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. And listen, happy Christmas. We'll see you in the new year, hopefully, when we can all go out and travel.
Well, happy Christmas to you and all of your listeners.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah, the tech world is running away with itself, isn't it? I mean, that was an interesting stat about the valuation of Apple being three times the GDP of Ireland.
I know.
That's and just
the, and the Irish GDP figure is already inflated by Apple because of all the multinationals here. So, but it is.
Okay,
it puts things into context that Apple is worth more than three times this country, that all the whole GDP, everything added up together, which is kind of phenomenal. And then you think, okay, how does this play out? How does a company that makes no profits, now I'm not talking about Apple,
let's say
Airbnb or some of those delivery companies or Uber, right? How does a company that makes no profits become valued at 100 billion euros?
Mm.
Dollars, sorry, which is Airbnb. And then the question is to get into the mentality of the speculator and the investor. So there's two quite different types of players in financial markets. The speculator loves technology because technology disrupts.
Yeah.
And when you get disruption, you get these massive swings in hope value. So, for example, if you get a situation where you think, well, Airbnb is going to disrupt the hotel industry forever, then what you're doing is you're banking on Airbnb owning everything, owning the whole industry in 5 or 6 years' time. So it's the technological change plus the cultural change that drives the speculator. And the speculator comes from the Latin speculare, which means to look out for. So spectacle, spectator, it all comes from the same word. And these guys were, the Romans were great speculators. The Romans had all sorts of financial crashes. After the Greeks, the Romans was the first big urban civilization that couldn't feed itself.
It's quite interesting. Okay.
They couldn't feed themselves, right? Because they didn't have hinterland around it, right?
Mm.
So the Romans had to figure out all sorts of really highfalutin financial, almost derivatives.
Was that what drove the expansion of the empire? Was not just kind of obviously gold and power and land and all of this, but started with a need for food?
I think what happened was what drove the Roman Empire was their unbelievable dexterity with money. They were incredibly good with money.
Right.
They were really innovative because they had to figure out how do we coax the rest of the world to give us grain? What can we do? Now, we can go around the world kicking lumps out of them, which we did, right? But their big agricultural move the Romans took was taking over Egypt.
Right.
Cleopatra and, and Anthony, Mark Anthony and all that.
Yeah,
stuff.
That
was a grain play.
It's a great movie.
It was a great movie. But it was a grain play. It was a play for wheat, right?
Right, so okay.
We forget now, because when we think of Egypt now, we think of quite a barren place. We think of a place that's quite deserty, etc.
Yeah.
However, in the ancient world, the River Nile was the key artery in the world.
Yeah.
So all around the Nile Delta was probably the most fertile lands in all of what they call the known world. And the Romans, of course, needed to feed themselves. So what they did was they had this pincer movement of Caesar, Mark Antony, the whole thing. This is the end of the Republic, and Cleopatra being the name we all know.
Yeah.
But the idea there was to actually secure grain supplies. In fact, even going further back to that, the Punic Wars, Carthage, do you remember that? Hannibal?
I remember Carthage.
Hannibal
yes,
was,
yeah, 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 the
so
elephants.
Hannibal took the elephants up around North Africa, up through Spain, right?
Yeah.
That was over.
That was a crazy move.
That was a crazy move, yeah. It was a crazy play. It was a punch. I was a spectator of a punch.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, the grain story. But what I want to come back to is part of the firmament of Roman society was the speculator.
Mm.
Always regarded as a bit beyond the pale, because people didn't really know what this geezer was up to.
Yeah.
But the reason they called him the speculator was, it wasn't just the translator, watch out for. It was that they could see things others couldn't.
Right.
So there was
spotting the opportunity.
Yeah. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Speculation.
Yeah.
But the speculator loves technology, because the speculator understands that technology gives disruption, and with disruption you have supernormal profits.
Right.
The investor, on the other hand, so the speculator loves turbulent times and change.
Yeah.
The investor, on the other hand, likes no change, likes the status quo. He's steady Eddie. He wants an income, or she wants an income coming in every year, right?
And they come in fast on the heels of the speculator.
Yeah, so the speculator,
when it settles down a bit.
Yeah, so the speculator is like the pioneer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the investor is like the settler.
Yeah.
But there comes a moment where the investor misdiagnoses an opportunity and believes that it's an investment opportunity, when in fact it's only a speculative opportunity. And that's what's happening in Silicon Valley right now.
Ooh, okay.
You see, so the idea is you don't invest in these companies. You're basically taking a punt that everything is going to go right and those companies are going to emerge. But if you look back at history, John, as we like to do, having just made a little segue into the Nile and Cleopatra and all that, what you see is great moments of technological change tend to come at great moments of financial speculation. And if the rate of interest is low at that time, what you will get is a profound, profound speculative bubble in that asset.
Well,
now, it doesn't mean that everyone loses money.
Yeah.
But what it does mean is, if you come late to the party, if you pick the wrong company, you can lose everything. Or if you come to the party and you pick the right company, you can gain a fortune.
So just going back to the near history of the dot-com bubble in the 90s, what were the interest rates like back then?
So what happened in the late 90s? Very good question, John. Thank you very much.
As I was working
in the markets at the time.
Right.
Okay. What happened was, in 1997, I found myself in a hotel in Kowloon in Hong Kong.
Right.
At the IMF's on Halloween night, 1997. Imagine this. Big foyer, massive hotel. The IMF's annual bash. The IMF has an annual bash every year, right? And economists.
I'd say that's a humdinger, is it?
It is actually. In actual fact, that night I went on the lash with Ken Clark.
No way.
Yeah, I'll tell you all about him in a second, right? A brilliant night.
Is he a bit of crack?
He's great fun. He's a total laugh. He's a complete laugh. In fact, I'll tell you the story. The story he told was brilliant. So we're sitting up there in this hotel in Kowloon, this big posh hotel. And Ken's there, and he's got the hush puppies. You know, he wears hush puppies.
Yes, he does. Yeah, he's
big cigar.
That. Yeah.
Big pints of beer, chatting away. It's about four of us. I was with an English guy who knew him, right?
Right.
So we all met up. But he told a great story of how politicians have their rashers, right? And he explained the story. It's a beautiful. He explained, on the day of Black Wednesday, when Sterling fell out of the ERM in 1992, right? When the British currency collapsed, George Soros speculated against it. It collapsed and it totally changed the world. Kent Clark is Home Secretary. Michael Heseltine is Foreign Secretary.
Right.
Norman Lamont is the Treasury.
Yeah.
Right? And John Major is the Prime Minister, right? And at the time, the currency was collapsing. Ken Clark tells the story of the four of them around a transistor in the kitchen of number 10, listening to BBC telling them what was happening to the currency that they were supposed to be in control of. He just said, isn't that mad?
That's incredible.
Yeah. And he said, you should see the four of us. We had no clue what was going on. And that's the beauty of Ken Clark. He's like, he tells those stories. Yeah, he says, this is the reality. And he said, then I'd have to come out and face the press.
Yeah.
And he said, he chest out and said, we are absolutely convinced of the veracity of our currency. And he go back in, he said, what the fuck's happening?
That's brilliant.
So that night.
Well, that was the power of the BBC.
It was the power of the BBC back then, yeah. So they were listening to BBC Radio 4, telling them what was happening to the currency that they were meant to be in charge of.
Yeah.
And that shows you what happens when financial markets take control. It's a very interesting discussion for democracy and political representation we might come back to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, actually.
But during Halloween night, Halloween massacre of 1997, I was in Hong Kong because the Asian crisis was going on. Do you remember the Asian crisis of Thailand devalued, Indonesia devalued?
Yeah.
Malaysia devalued.
I have a vague memory of this
and,
stuff.
And Hong Kong, the Hong Kongers were the next in line. So it was a big speculative wave against all these countries. Now, what happened then is to ask about the dot-com. Mm. The way in which the world tried to combat the Asian crisis and then the subsequent Russian default, which was in 1998.
Right.
So the Asians defaulted. The Asian crisis was 1997.
Yeah.
Phenomenally exciting time to be working in that business. And then the Russians defaulted in 1998. Again, a bit too exciting times, believe me, to be working in that business, right? But the way in which the Federal Reserve in America reacted to all this turbulence as they dropped interest rates dramatically.
Okay.
Okay. To try and cool things down, which it did. But to your question, why did the dot-com start at that time? The very reduction in interest rates, which was meant to cool down the emerging markets problems,
right,
gave the opportunity for the speculators.
So it's very similar to
exactly the same stuff, right? And the speculators came in and they said, ooh, let's value pets.com at 20 billion or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's exactly the same process. And interestingly, the way in which the Federal Reserve reacted to the dot-com collapse was again to reduce interest rates right down to zero, which fueled the real estate bubble in the United States from 2000 to 2007, which burst in 2007. Yeah. So they're all of a piece.
So come here, let me ask you a question then. If there wasn't that Asian crisis and the Russian default and all the rest, they wouldn't have dropped the interest rates. The Fed wouldn't have dropped the interest rates.
Yeah.
If they hadn't dropped the interest rates, are you saying the bubble wouldn't have happened or wouldn't have happened in such a bubbly kind of way?
Wouldn't happen in such a bubbly way. Yes, that's very Bertie Ahern. The boom is getting boomier.
Yes.
Gotta love the Bert.
Bertie.
Right, gotta love the Bert when it comes to the boom is getting boomier. Yeah, the bubble is getting bubblier, right?
Right.
Okay, so exactly. So the cost of capital, the rate of interest is very, very important for all these things. So then you think, okay, what's going on now? So we've got the difference between the speculator and the investor. We've got the global financial crisis that is COVID, which is, as you said, could be paralleled to the global financial crisis that was the default of the Asian and emerging markets.
Yeah.
Same type of dynamics going on. And then you've got to think, is this always the case? And if we go back further, John, back much further, and look out the window here at the Dunleary Railway.
Yeah.
The Dunleary Railway used to be called the Kingstown Dublin Railway Line.
Yeah.
The first suburban railway in the world.
Oh, really?
First in the world. Suburban, right?
Right, okay. Right, yeah. Wow.
1833.
Right.
The first actual railway was in a place called Stockton in the north of England, which was in 1827. So it was very, very close.
Wow.
Now, the reason I'm coming to the railways is I want to go back a little bit further, right? Which is the speculative mania that was the canals, right? You know, the Royal Canal.
I do.
Think about the Royal Canal, right? Now it's really, you know, you can sit around and have your lunch and blah, blah, blah. But the first big speculative mania in this country was on canal shares, because canals started in the UK. There's a guy called Bridgewater, the Duke of Bridgewater, the first canal, I think, in 1867. And what the canals did, they revolutionized what you could do transporting agriculture, transporting materials, much quicker than going overland. and you connected places together that were never connected in the past.
Yeah.
So the cost of transport collapsed. And as the cost of transport collapsed, the values of these shares and canals went through the roof, right? So you had this total canal mania. And the Brits in the north of England and the Midlands, they connected an amazing network. Actually, you've worked on that, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I worked with British Waterways for a little while in the media department. But yeah, British Waterways looks after 2,000 miles of canals and inland navigable waterways. And it's a fascinating... They called that part of Birmingham, the Grand Canal and the other canals, the Venice of Britain.
Yeah. Of
course, everything is the Venice of something or other.
Yeah, but it's true. But that's where Peaky Blinders is. You know, they're always on the canal. They're always, you know, Tommy Shelby always is a lad on the canal. So the canals was a phenomenal, exactly like...
It's an amazing piece of engineering.
It is an amazing piece of engineering.
Absolutely.
And think, the canals in 1790 was like Silicon Valley now.
Yeah.
It's exactly... It's a technology that's going to change the world. Now, what happened then was, of course, the shares in canals, because these were all built by private companies. They were never built by the public, right? The shares in canals and canal industry went through the roof, leading to a speculative mania that everybody wanted to own a canal, everybody wanted to own a share in these canal companies, and everybody wanted to build a canal. And of course, what we did in Ireland was we decided, we came late to the party, unfortunately. We started the Royal Canal in 1791.
Right.
By 1794, the Royal Canal Company was bankrupt. So what happened?
What happened?
This is the interesting thing. And this is when an investment is based on hope.
Yeah.
It becomes unbelievably sensitive to being hit by events that have nothing to do with it.
Okay? Right, right. Right? Okay.
So what happens in 1792, 1793, the French Revolutionary Wars. Off in his head, Robespierre pointed at him, you're a bollocks, I'm going to kill you, Danton, the whole thing, right? Yeah. The terror in France, which terrified the aristocracy here. And if you really want to get into that sort of stuff, Edmund Burke, his Reflections on the Terror in France, shows you what the upper class thought of what was going on in France. They were petrified because they thought, if this French revolutionary virus spreads to Britain, we will all be killed.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So their whole perception of the future totally changed. They went from being unbelievably optimistic about the future to unbelievably pessimistic about the future, right? And once you become pessimistic, all your investments and your perception of what happens, and people start to sell shares. And so what you see is the guillotine, Robespierre and the guillotine in France does for the Royal Canal. The Royal Canal doesn't get completed until 1817, right? Because they ran out of money. And then by the time they'd completed it, over the horizon was the new technology, the steam engine.
Right, yeah, of course.
Which made it into, so they turned the Royal Canal really into a tourist thing. It was, it lost all its commercial nous. And that's what I'm saying is that when you buy companies at these valuations, everything has to go right for these valuations to stay, right?
But you just mentioned something there about the speculators being hypersensitive.
Yeah.
Of outside, you know, global events and stuff. This is what I don't understand about Airbnb, is that there are global events going on, i.e. pandemic.
Yeah.
And also, you mentioned about the French Revolution. There's the kind of rise of populism as well.
Yeah.
So why didn't that affect the future? Because nobody can actually speculate now on how the tourist industry is going to go.
No. As a travel industry.
Travel industry. So why is it valued at so? I don't get it.
So it's priced for blue skies. And when you're priced for blue skies and it starts to rain, you get drenched.
Yeah.
So
okay.
take that idea that the railway guys, exactly the same, the technology, speculators. Now, the problem is the speculators usually speculate. They were Jonathan Swift used to call them the locusts in the coffee houses.
Right.
Okay.
Nice.
So, and they trade all the time. It's the person who misdiagnoses a speculative opportunity for a long-term investment. They're the people who get burned.
Yeah.
So the speculators are in and out.
Yeah.
But they always sell on. It's the greater fool theory. You know, you sell on to Egypt. And then the Egypt believes the hype, and then the Egypt ends up owning the share in a company that has collapsed, like the Royal Dublin Canal Company.
Right, here. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Now, of course, what happened, think about what else happened. When was the Act of Union in Ireland? 1801. When was our Tone Rebellion? 1798. So you're talking about a period where the aristocracy in Ireland lose their shirt on the canals.
Yeah.
They're already really nervous. They're terrified of France. Wolfe Tone comes in and basically says, I'm going to do a mini France here.
Right, yeah.
That freaks them out completely. And what do? They run to Mother Britain and incorporate Ireland and Britain in the Act of Union, all stemming from the collapse in share prices.
Right.
Isn't
okay.
it fascinating?
Yeah, yeah,
and of
yeah.
course, there was a huge amount of bribery went on at the time.
Yeah.
So the bribery involved in bribing the aristocracy to actually renege on Dublin, turn their back on Dublin. And once they turned their back on Dublin, the city went into decline. And that's what happened. Which is kind of, and it's all, and then
yeah, yeah.
you come to the next phase, which is the railway shares.
Railways, yeah, yeah.
And the railway shares exactly the same. They're going to change the world. And they did change the world.
Mm.
They're going to change, like, I mean, even they changed the lexicon, even the idea to build up a head of steam. Like, railway terminology came into the people's lexicon.
Yeah.
And again, exactly the same thing. So we have here 1833 railway built, right? It's called the Atmospheric Railway.
Yes.
It's quite nice.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
All around Dublin, all around Ireland, then you get this, again, massive speculative mania on railway shares. The crazy thing about Ireland was during the famine, think about it, 1846.
Yeah.
People were dying in the west of the country and people in the east of the country were worried about their share prices. And that's the truth. There was a mass, I mean, of course, rich people I'm talking about
yeah,
in the east
yeah,
of the country. But there was, we don't seem to get our head around the fact that there was five or six different things here happening at the same time.
Mm.
And the railway mania was happening at the same time right. as people were starving to death. And we were building railways at the same time.
So were the railway speculators then, were they more ignorant of what was going on out west, or were they just chose to ignore it?
I think they chose to ignore it. I think the interesting thing about the railways, it was opening up the country. So it meant that you couldn't remain ignorant for that long.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
because it was actually, there was a thing called railway time. They were changing how we perceived time because the railways were so much
of course,
quicker
yeah,
than
yeah.
either the canals or the horse and cart. But, and this is germane to our Silicon Valley conversation.
Mm.
What you always get in manias is far too much exuberance, effervescence, people feeling that this time it's different, people feeling that we can't lose. And then when people lose their shirts and the market collapse, you always get fraud, right? Because there's always, in the middle of a speculative mania, there's always a fraudster. There's always somebody
right.
trying to take money from some people, promising them this, promising them that, and not delivering. And here in Ireland, the major fraudster was a guy called John Sadleir, MP.
Right.
Who was an MP for Tipperary, from the Irish Parliamentary Party.
Okay.
Parnell's party,
mm-hmm.
Isaac Butt, all those good fellows,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Sadleir ends up committing suicide on Primrose Hill in London. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what happened was he embezzled fortunes out of average punters, telling them he was going to invest in railway shares in exotic locations like Sweden at the time. Entirely fictitious. Entirely fictitious.
Okay.
And obviously was using the money to pay off other debts. And you see that happening all the time. This is the Bernie Madoff.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
That type of thing, the swindler in the middle.
This reminds me of the monorail episode in the Simpsons.
I didn't see the monorail.
Oh, no, you have to see that one.
Go
monorail,
on.
Monorail, monorail, monorail. And it's about this guy who comes in, the town, Springfield, get a whole load of money. And they're all, hey, let's go and do something with it. And this swindler comes in and sells them a monorail.
Well, sir, there's nothing on earth like a genuine, bona fide, electrified six-car monorail. What'd I say?
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
That's right, monorail.
Monorail. Monorail. Monorail.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
It glides as softly as a cloud.
Is there a chance the track could bend?
Not on your life, my Hindu friend.
What about us Brendan slobs?
You'll be given cushy jobs.
I swear it's Springfield's only choice. Throw up your hands and raise your voice.
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
I love it. Well, it's the same
yeah,
idea.
Absolutely.
It's the same idea. And that's what makes The Simpsons brilliant, because it's actually very true to life.
Yeah.
very, very true to life. So Sadleir ends up committing suicide. Big scandal in Ireland because Sadleir and his brothers set up a bank. Right? Think about how sophisticated these guys were.
Yeah.
They're from Clonmel. They set up a bank and they were, of course, they did the great thing, which is always get one brother in Parliament, right?
Yeah.
Close to the political. Fella close, you know, yeah.
Position everyone nicely
and then do your thing. So I suppose the conclusion is when I see the Airbnb, I'm not talking about Airbnb itself, but what I'm thinking, the mania with all these IPOs, right?
Yeah.
Which are all being issued, going through the roof, everyone looking at blue skies. I think of canals. Mm. Go for a walk on the Royal Canal and imagine the amount of labour.
It was incredible.
And even that expression, the Irish Navy.
Yeah.
The Irish Navy comes from the Irish Navigator. And the reason they were called navigators was because they were working in the wet. They were working in the water.
Yeah.
And so the Irish Navy, because Irish navies built the canals.
Yeah.
And they built, obviously, the canals here, but they built them in the UK. But when I look at that, I always think, wow, somebody thought that this was going to change the world and bet their house on it, and it didn't. And when I get the Dart here now, from Dunleary into town, those railway lines are the same lines that were laid in 1833, like nearly 200 years ago.
Yeah, the ones we used to put pennies on. and watch the train squash them.
Yeah,
it was brilliant.
Exactly. So what I like is that technology changes the world, but not everybody who bets on technology wins.
Mm.
So we as a country have bet on technology, which makes complete sense. But when you look at all those speculators and you look at all those IPOs and you look at all those effervescence and you think back to the Russian crisis, the Asian crisis, you think back to the war in France, all these things that trigger changes, it just suggests to me that one of the lessons of 2020 is maybe COVID has taken our eye off the ball of other risks
that are
out there in the world.
Yeah.
And when COVID dissipates in time, other risks will reemerge. And I think they will make some of those investments taken in 2020 look not only reckless, but incredibly stupid.
So don't drink the Kool-Aid.
Don't drink the Kool-Aid, exactly. What do you call it?
Caliphate capitalism.
I love that.
Caliphate capitalism.
This is like when we all bow down to the god and actually we lose our reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Caliphate capitalism, that's genius, genius.
We'll come back to that.
No. I'll write a book called that. Take all the royalties. I know you're sitting there worried about what you're going to give that person you love for Christmas. Give them the gift of knowledge. With the Dave McWilliams podcast. We're going to give you, for December only, a full year's membership with a 15% discount. So, for that person you love, who loves economics, loves learning, loves the crack, loves all this carry-on, Dave McWilliams podcast, Christmas special present, patreon.com/Dave McWilliams.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.